I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Eve Ensler's The Vagina Monologues debuted in 1994 based on interviews she did with women about sex and their bodies. It was a sensation, performed all over the world, translated into some 50 languages. On a personal note, I sat in for a week when the roadshow came to Philadelphia, had a chance to tell these women's stories. It was thrilling and it was scary. Eve Ensler has focused most of her career on women's bodies, writing in The Body of the World about her cancer scare and The Good Body about her, quote, post-40s stomach. Her new book, The Apology, is about what her father did to her body and how it has affected her life. Beginning at the age of 5, he sexually abused her, and when she was older, that abuse turned violent, even terrorizing her psychologically. He never acknowledged or apologized for his brutality, something Eve Ensler said she needed. So her book is her father's apology to her, written in her own words. Eve Ensler is a Tony Award-winning playwright. She's an author, performer, activist, founder of V-Day, the global movement to end violence against women and girls, also 1 Billion Rising. That's an organization to end gender-based violence. And she joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Eve Ensler, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you with us. I'd love to have you read the very beginning, the introduction to your book.
With pleasure. I am done waiting. My father is long dead. He will never say the words to me. He will not make the apology. So it must be imagined, for it is in our imagination that we dream across boundaries, deepen the narrative, and design alternative outcomes. This letter is an invocation, a calling up. I've tried to allow my father to speak to me as he would speak. Although I've written the words I needed my father to say to me, I had to make space for him to come through me. There is so much about him, his history, that he never shared with me, so I've had to conjure much of that as well. This letter is my attempt to endow my father with the will and the words to cross the border and speak the language of apology so that I can finally be free.
Are you free?
I am.
Because of this book? Because of writing this book?
Well, this book comes at the end of, 60 years.
I get it.
Of recovery and trying to weave my way out to rise from the ashes. But this book took me far in the final. And look, we don't know. You never know. I mean, since I finished the book, it feels very different. My father feels really gone. And I can feel the way he impacted me in the way I respond to things, the way I think. It's just changed. So, I feel free.
Well, it's interesting. I read the book yesterday in preparation for the interview, and I feel like I think every emotion I had was experience, that you really touched on that, which made me wonder, what was it like for Eve Ensler to write this book, to, in a sense, get inside your father's head?
Well, I think, once I made the decision, and let me just go back a little bit to say why I wrote it so, people are clear. As a person who survived childhood sexual abuse from the age of 5 till 10, and then after my father essentially kind of wanted to destroy any evidence of what he had already destroyed, so he became very, very violent to me for the rest of my time at home. And I think I always thought, he would apologize to me. And I was always writing apologies to him and always in this desire to kind of provoke his apology. And then, okay, so that was one piece of it. Then my father died and I waited for...
And that was about 30 years ago,
31
right?
years ago. And I think I just always dreamed, even though he was dead, that there'd somehow be this reckoning. Then I've watched, worked in the anti-violence movement to all women for the last 21 years, every day of my life, 12 hours a day, listening to stories. And then with the recent iteration of Me Too, I see how women have called men out. We've told our stories. We've broken the silence. We've built hotlines and shelters. And it suddenly hit me. I have never heard a man make a thorough, authentic public apology for sexual or domestic or gender abuse. And I thought, how's that possible? And I then thought to myself, well, maybe I could write the apology I needed to hear in my father's voice, saying the words, creating the structure of an apology. Hmm. And it might help me, and maybe it might be a blueprint for other people to make apologies and also to write their own to themselves.
Well, it's interesting because obviously a book called The Apology, and I thought a lot about, well, what is an apology? What does that entail? What does it mean for the person apologizing? How is it received? You use the word reckoning. Do you think that's what an apology sort of bottom line is about, a reckoning?
I think an apology is many things. And I want to just begin by saying, you know, this book is an offering, not a prescription. There are
Absolutely.
Some people who may not want apologies or don't even think about apologies, and all survivors know what they need. There's no pressure. This is not another have-to-do thing. If this book serves you, great. But I think a couple of things. I think we teach children how to pray. Right. We teach them about the devotion of prayer and the concentration of prayer. We teach them about the humbling of the petition. But we don't teach children how to apologize. An apology is a process. It's a journey. It's a practice. It's a humbling. It's making yourself vulnerable. It's an equalizer. It's, first of all, doing a detailed account of your misdeeds, because the liberation is in the details. It's feeling what your victim felt and going inside your victim to say, what did my actions create? What feelings? What were the impact of that on her, on her family, on the world around her? It's going back in your own history and doing radical self-interrogation and investigation. What about my life led me to become a man who could incest my daughter, who could beat my daughter, who could almost kill my daughter? How did I become this pedophile? How did I become this sadist? What are the ingredients that made me up? And then I think it's really becoming accountable.
Hmm.
And so much so that your victim knows that you couldn't possibly do that again.
Well, I have to say, reading through the book, but also from other interviews that I have done, is that when there is sexual violence within the family, the perpetrator, the victim, survivor, they know each other so well. And the child knows that parent so well because they have to watch them. They have to be constantly vigilant, in a sense, on guard, to know, to see what might be coming next.
Mm-hmm. I think that was one of the most interesting things about writing this book. And I would say, like, of course I want the book to be an outline and possibly a blueprint for men to really look at what is an apology. But I also discovered how effective it was for me as a survivor to write myself a letter from my perpetrator, because, just like you said, our perpetrators live inside us. They, you know, as a child, you know their footsteps, you know their moods better than anybody. And once they enter you or beat you or rape you or stain you, they are in you, and you're in constant dialogue with them your whole life, whether you're conscious of it or not. But writing this book, I was able to turn my father inside me from this monolithic monster to an apologist, from the kind of this terrifying hanging entity to a broken, confused, vulnerable human being. And by doing so, he lost agency over me. I got agency over my life.
But you, in a sense, forced your dad to apologize, right?
Well, I wouldn't say force. I allowed him.
You allowed him, right. You invited him to,
yes,
to figure out how to apologize,
yes,
to you. You know, I have to say, there were times, because this is written in the first person, so it's I, and there were a couple times I said, no, this is not Eve Ensler talking. It's her dad talking. And I know the audiobook is in the voice of a man.
I can't tell you how strange writing this book was, because I feel like I went into a kind of four-month trance where my father literally was present. He was present. He was there. And I felt him speaking through me. And I know my father's dead, but I have to say the dead are all around us. Yeah. I really believe we are in constant dialogue with the dead, and they need us to be in dialogue with them to get free. And sometimes, literally, he would use vocabulary I don't use. His authorial voice was certainly not my voice. His cold. I mean, it wasn't me. And it was just shocking to me to see how much he inhabits me, and how much our perpetrators and our live in us and come through us.
You talk about understanding and write a little bit about your parents. But as you said in the introduction, there are things you do not know. But you talk about how your dad was raised, kind of a special project of his own mother. And even this German doctor, Schreiber, was that true? Was that the kind of...
There was lots of conjuring in this book.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had to go and look back. My father was a complete believer in punishment and making the child pain was the way you taught people. Pain was how you, and I know that's the way I was brought up. So I try to look for roots of where that could be. It's very clear to me my father was an adored child because he came much later than the other children in his family. And, you know, adoration is not love. And I think we need to really make a distinction. Like when we adore people, we put them on pedestals. We project onto them our desire for who we want to be. And that becomes a kind of prison, right? People have to, are pressured to live up to this idea we have of them. So it actually disables them or makes it impossible for them to be human, to be tender, to be lost, to be vulnerable, to not know because they're constantly being pressured to be this idealized image or idealized person of the person making up or who is adoring them. And I think for my father, he then pushed all the feelings that didn't go along with being adored underground. And that sort of metastasized into what he calls the shadow man who later surfaced.
Yeah, this is almost like an alter ego in a way, right? Who terrorized you.
Yes, and who I think my father had very little control over.
Oh,
I think once that shadow man surfaced, whether it was in sexually abusing me, and I think the sexual abuse really began because all that tenderness my father had killed off or pushed down or had been killed off in him, when I was born, he suddenly was flooded with it. And because no one had ever taught him to be tender with himself, to feel, to sit with tenderness, to know how to just be in awe of tenderness, he didn't know what to do with it. So he had to kill it. He had to rape it. He had to manhandle it. He had to exploit it. He had to, and I think that along with this rage and violence that was brewing under there was a lethal combination.
He comes across as a very lonely, I mean, clearly isolated, but a very, very lonely man.
I think he was.
You sense that as a child?
I did. I think I always felt his loneliness and melancholy. I think he, and now looking back on it, it's very clear to me that he was never allowed to be steeped in his humanity. He was robbed of his complexity. He was robbed of his heart. He was robbed of his heart. And so once you begin that divide, and I think we do this to boys, we absolutely separate them from their hearts at a very young age so that they lose empathy. They lose the ability to feel what somebody else is feeling. How could somebody rape a woman who is screaming no, 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 if he hadn't lost his ability to feel for what she was feeling?
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Eve Ensler, our guest on Radio Times today. You probably know her as the author of The Vagina Monologues. Her new book is called The Apology, and it's an apology that she has written for her father, in her father's voice, to her for the kind of abuse that she suffered growing up in their family. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Eve Ensler about her new book, and it's called The Apology. And again, it's about what she endured with her father, both abusing her as a young girl, starting at the age of 5, how that abuse turned physical and violent and even involved a kind of psychological terrorism. Not easy stuff to talk about, but Eve Ensler has a way of talking about things that cannot be talked about. Before the break, you were talking about just your father. How do I put this? You were daddy's little girl, as you describe it. And as you describe him and you as a little girl, it almost felt like he was in love with you in that sort of obsessive first love kind of thing where you can't get that person out of your mind and everything about them. You just want it because you're in love.
I think it was very much that. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, he was obsessed with me. And just thought I was everything. And it was very bizarre because he had other children and he had a wife and all the attention was on me. And looking back, I can see, you know, with the kind of inequality and tension and jealousy and divide that created in the family, but also to have gone from such a special place in his heart,
right,
to have been the most adored, because he adored me. Again, did he love me? No, because he didn't
see. Was that pedestal you were talking about?
Yes, he didn't see me. I wasn't a real person to him, because if I was, he could never have done what he did to me. He adored me. And so to go from that kind of grandiose adoration to after the incest finally ended, and have him turn on me and have me rendered to nothing, no status, no love, no attention, just bad. I was bad from that point on. The fall was far. It was far. And, you know, sometimes I wonder, before this book, if I would ever recover from that fall, to go from most adored to most hated.
But part of that adoration, and this is where it gets really tricky and really scary, is, of course, the sexual abuse. And as you write about it, from his perspective, again, whatever that sort of barrier that prevents a parent, especially a father, from abusing his daughter, that just kind of slips away. And next thing you know, he's visiting you at night.
Well, I think, again, and one of the things I want to say is, in the book, my father explains things, but he doesn't justify them. And I think there's a difference between explanation and justification. Emma Goldman once says, we can't forgive people until we understand them. And I think there's something really true about knowing why. I think survivors are haunted by why. Why would my best friend drug me and rape me? Why would my father want to kill and rape his own child? I mean, why?
Right.
And I think when you go through and you begin to look at the things that led it, it's very helpful in releasing you from this overwhelming existential quandary, you know? So what was the question? I'm sorry.
I was so engrossed in your answer, I totally forgot. That's okay.
Oh, yeah, about my father and the sexual abuse.
Oh, yeah, the sort of seductive part.
I think when it started, I'm sure my father knew consciously, unconsciously, how wrong it was. But I also go back to that my father had no ability to feel the intensity of what he was feeling. He didn't know how to contain it. He didn't know how to control it. He didn't know what it was, because no one had felt that about him, and he had never felt it about himself, and he had never been allowed to feel it about the world. And so he acted out. Yeah. He did terrible things. He invaded my body. He took what he wanted. He went all the way. And, of course, the mind, I mean, it's just, incest is such, destroys your mind, destroys your body, destroys your future. It is such a confusing prison of so many complicated emotions. It's your father who you adore. You want to be adored by him. You want to be loved by him. You know someplace something's really invasive and wrong. Yet you don't want to stop it because you don't want it to stop loving you. It's pleasurable, and you're horrified that it's pleasurable. Everything about it just destroys your capacity for intimacy. It distorts your desire. It corrupts your sexuality. It forces you to betray your mother, so you have guilt and horrible shame. And ultimately, one of the books I once read about incest said that children need to long for their mother if they're a boy, and they need to long for their father. It's part of childhood sexual development. But if someone comes and they take advantage of that, they kill your yearning. They kill your ability to develop your sexual yearning. So that's a horrible death, you know?
You talk about your mother, or your mother has an appearance in this book, and Beverly says, what about your mother's apology for allowing your father to abuse you? And your mother did apologize.
My mother
to you.
Did, and it's a very good question, because I think those who enable perpetrators, we've got to start looking at their role in all of this, and how do we help people begin to be braver. But I'll tell you the truth about my mother. My mother was a woman who was very poor. She came from the Midwest. She didn't have a great education. She didn't have a job. She didn't have training. She was there with three children. My father was indeed abusing us. And even if she didn't know, quote, consciously about the sexual abuse, she certainly knew about all the other abuse he was doing to me physically. And when I finally confronted my mother, and I want to say my mother and I went through a very long, deep, rich process of cleaning this up before she left this world. But she said to me, point blank, I sacrificed you.
Yeah. That's a powerful thing. She sacrificed her daughter to what? Save her marriage?
To save her economically. Because my mother didn't have the economic wherewithal to leave my father. Now, I like to believe that's not a choice I would make. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't my mother. And I wasn't living in her times. And I wasn't living in her shoes. And believe me, I had enormous rage at my mother for a long time for not protecting me. And in some ways, enabling my father. And she was in there with my father. Because I do think my mother had enormous anger at me and jealousy for all the doting and attention my father had paid to me early on. And I think when he turned on me, part of her was relieved by that.
Wow. I mean, a kind of a triangle within the family. And your siblings?
I don't talk about them.
You
because
don't?
I feel like they're alive and they have their own lives.
Absolutely. No, I totally get that. And it sounded as if the sexual abuse then became physical and violent when you began to be an older young girl who could say no to her father, or perhaps wasn't as in love with her father as often very young girls are, and that you sort of staked out your own independence, and he saw that as a kind of violation.
Oh, absolutely. I remember the first time I turned away from him and refused him, and it was really the last time he sexually abused me in that form. There were other forms. But he just went into a rage. And my father was not a person you could say no to. My father was not a person. My father had all the control. He had all the power. He just made the decisions of the family. He told everybody how to behave, how to act, what to feel, what to do. We lived in a dictatorship.
I was just going to say dictatorship.
No, it was
right?
A dictatorship. And this country is beginning to feel more and more like it every day. And I think the one thing that saved me, I mean, there were several things that saved me, but one thing that saved me was that I was a very defiant person. And although it got me into a lot of trouble and violence, there was something about refusing my father that, for me, kept my soul intact. You know, everybody can't do that. Everybody's made differently. And who knows why I was made as a defiant person, but I was made as a defiant person. And I think once I started resisting him, then I was to receive the wrath of his violence.
And while it was physical, he also convinced you you were a liar.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently you were not a liar.
I was so obsessively honest because my father would torture me every day about being a liar that it literally if somebody got accused of stealing something in like my grade school, I would raise my hand because I was sure it was me. Do you know what I mean?
Even if he brainwashed you.
No, completely. And you know, we had a joke with my friends. Like I would say, could you pass the butter? I'm sorry. Could I wear your shirt? I'm sorry. I couldn't stop saying I'm sorry. It was drilled into me to the point where my friends were like, we can't be your friends anymore if you don't stop saying it. It was like a tick, you know, just something you said over and over. And that's because he made me feel every day of my life that I was a liar, that I was stupid, that I was bad, that I was a jackass. I mean, the words, the language, it was a pounding.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Eve Ensler, our guest on Radio Times today. As I mentioned earlier, she, of course, is the author of The Vagina Monologue. She is a performer, a Tony-winning playwright, a performer, an activist. And again, she's got a new book. It's called The Apology. And it is an apology that she has written for her father, apologizing to her for his abusive treatment of her as she was growing up. You talk about his charm. That it had sort of a double-edged sword. One was to lure people, as charming people will do, and then to confuse them.
It's so true. I mean, you know, my father was of that generation, you know, where he grew up with Cary Grant and Valentino and all those people. So I really think he got his idea of himself through the movies. And he was very handsome and so charming and so seductive. And so from the outside world, even in the inside world, like you would look at this man and you would think, wow, he's so beautiful. And then this shadow man who lived inside him would be just like, where is this coming from? And I think he fooled a lot of people on the outside world into believing he was this charming business executive with this stunningly beautiful wife and this white picket fence and this house in upper middle class suburbia. And meanwhile, inside, the torture and violence and demeaning and degrading. And so for me, I think one of the reasons I've always been so obsessed about breaking silences and saying what cannot be said and telling the truth is that living this dual life where I was being constantly reminded how lucky I was to have the privilege of being upper middle class or living in this neighborhood or going to the school, all I felt was unlucky. All I felt was I'm going to die any day. And no one's talking about and no one's letting me talk about or giving me any opportunity or there's no one I can go to tell them the hell that is going on here.
Did he break you?
No. No. Did he?
He tried.
Did he almost break me?
He wanted to, as you write about him.
I think there were a period of years after I left home where if you looked at me from the outside, I would have appeared to be broken. Mm-hmm. I think writing and studying and doing all that in school, again, was this dual personality where I had to achieve and achieve. But underneath that, I was self-hating. I was an alcoholic. I was an addict. I was promiscuous. I was very suicidal. I just wanted someone to kill me and get it over with. It was like if I could have just ended my life at a certain point, and several points, I would have been very, very happy. And, you know, I think through many factors, through incredible people who have come into my life at the right time and put out a hand to me through 12-step programs, through really imagination and really picturing a future that wasn't what I was living in, right? I was able to really activism, yeah. You know? I mean, people always say, well, how did you get out of this? You know, if you give what you need the most, you begin to heal yourself. And I learned at an early age that if I could reach out to people who were a little worse off than me and just try to be helpful, I could get out of my own stuff and get out of my own head and begin to push myself along. And I think activism is so beautiful in that respect because as you're trying to reach out to other people, you know, you're healing whatever is broken inside your own self.
Is that also true for writing for you? And I'm thinking even when you wrote you did the interviews for the Vagina Monologues back in the 1990s, were you conscious of what had happened to you and this was a way for you to understand other women's bodies and their experience of their own bodies?
I think consciousness is always layered. I think when I started the Vagina Monologues, I was certainly aware of what had happened to me. And when I did the interviews and then really turned them into fictional pieces and went through that process, I've always been searching for about our bodies. What happens to our bodies? How do we get back into our bodies? The shame we have about our bodies, the violence done to our bodies. Because I really do believe so much of who we are, so much of our power, so much of our confidence lives in our bodies, right? Our brains are our bodies. They're not separate from our bodies, right? And so if I look back, you know, at my life, I mean, I would say 60 years of my life has been spent trying to write myself out of this, trying to activate and struggle my way out of this. You know, it's been, and I don't think I'm unusual. I think any woman who's been through serious abuse, any man who's been through serious abuse, and I think, by the way, there's so many boys who have been through this experience, and I'm speaking to them as well. I think as we try to survive and have a life, so much, you know, of our lives are spent surviving rather than thriving. And that's why we have to stop violence. Because if we were thriving from the beginning, imagine what women could do. Imagine what all children could do who weren't battling trauma that is constantly threatening to pull them under.
You include at the very end of the book an apology that you write, I mean, that your dad writes for you, that, of course, you write in your dad's voice. I guess what's so interesting is that he didn't personally apologize to you, but he apologized in your book in your own words, and that worked.
It did work, and I'll tell you something. This exercise is really, really powerful. At City of Joy, which is our sanctuary
in the Congo, right?
In the Congo for women who've been tortured and terrorized in war, we have 90 women for every 6 months who come there to heal, and our director did this exercise with them 3 weeks ago. And she said she could not believe the power of it, that women were literally saying, oh, my God, I'm done. I mean, this guy's, because they really, because all of them know they're perpetrators, even if it was just a rape in the middle of a battlefield or the rape in the middle of a village that you didn't know somebody. You know the smell of that person. You know the texture of that person. You look in that person's eyes and you can see so much of his history in his face. And I think, you know, I would strongly suggest if you can't get an apology, to work with a therapist, a friend, a clergy, and go through the journey of writing yourself. And if you are a man who has done something terrible, go to somebody, seek out help, sit down with them, read this book, and look at the anatomy of an apology and look at what it would take to really go through a process to make thorough, authentic, deep amends that your victim will feel released by.
Here's an email from Sarah. She says, my former husband cheated on me and said, I'm sorry you got hurt. That's a quote there. I realize he used that language because he wouldn't or couldn't take ownership of his behavior. And there is a lot of deflection that can happen in certain kinds of apologies.
That's not an apology. No. That's not an apology. That's a Passover. I really believe that one of the key ingredients of an apology is a humbling, is making yourself vulnerable, is actually taking full responsibility for your actions in a detailed accounting way, and also looking at the hurt it's caused you and being specific about the hurt it's caused you and being specific about what you did. And, you know, my father's, and it's interesting what she's saying, because my father says in this book at one point, you know, to be an apologist is to be a traitor to all men. And that really, really shot through me. And what he means by that is that once one man apologizes and says he knows that what he was doing was wrong, the whole story kind of begins to collapse, which is why the apology is so critical. And we really just need a kind of small cadre of men, just 10% of the men, to begin to really go through this process and journey so we can begin to collapse the story of patriarchy.
We are talking with Eve Ensler about the patriarchy and about The Apology, the title of her new book. You can join us again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with Eve Ensler, Tony Award-winning playwright of The Vagina Monologue. She's an author, a performer, an activist, founder of V-Day, that's the global movement to end violence against women and girls, 1 Billion Rising, an organization to end gender-based violence. She also mentioned the work that she is doing in the Congo. And again, she's got a new book called The Apology. Let me play a clip, and this is Eve Ensler performing the opening of The Vagina Monologues. It opened at Here Arts Center in New York City. This is October 3rd, 1996.
I bet you're worried. I was worried. That's why I began this piece. I was worried about vaginas. I was worried what we think about vaginas, and I was even more worried that we don't think about them. I was worried about my own vagina. It needed a context, a community, a culture of other vaginas. There is so much darkness and secrecy surrounding them. Like the Bermuda Triangle, nobody ever reports back from there. In the first place, it's not so easy to even find your vagina. Women go days, weeks, months without looking at it. I interviewed a high-powered businesswoman. She told me she didn't have time. Looking at your vagina, she said, is a full day's work. You've got to get down there, on your back, in front of a mirror, full-length preferred. You've got to get in the perfect position with the perfect light, which then becomes shadowed by the angle you're at. You're twisting your head up, arching your back. It's exhausting. She was busy. She didn't have time. So I decided to talk to women about their vaginas. They began as casual vagina interviews, and they turned into vagina monologues.
And again, that's Eve Ensler back in 1996 performing the opening of The Vagina Monologues. As I mentioned, I sat in when the road show or the road tour came to Philadelphia, and It was so exciting and scary and thrilling. And there was humor. There was pathos. There were sort of moments that broke your heart, broke the rules. Are you surprised that it is, I guess, lived on? I don't know.
Oh, it's so surprising to me. You know, I mean, look, originally when I wrote it, I just hoped I'd do it and someone wouldn't shoot me. I mean, that was my goal. And just, you know, here we are 21 years later and V-Day, you know, I mean, last year I think there were 700 productions during the month of February. Mm-hmm. All those productions raising money for local groups that go to stop anti-violence groups in those communities. I look at all these amazing activists around the world, around this country, who have been raising thousands and thousands of dollars every year in their communities. And just, you know, I have a joke. I used to walk through the airport and people would say, oh, hey, yeah, I know you. I saw you in the vagina monologues. Now people go, hey, I was in the vagina monologues, you know. So it feels amazing. And I think what really feels incredible is to see how many women I meet now who are lawyers, social activists, and they say, that was the moment. Doing the vagina monologues was the moment I became an activist. Doing the vagina monologues was the moment I woke up, you know. And that's the reason why we write, right? That's the reason why we're artists. That's the reason we do what we do, to believe that transformation's possible.
And that words are transforming, right? I mean, saying the vagina monologues is so about saying the words.
So about saying the words, you know. And it's funny because I was thinking the other day how The Guardian just switched. They're no longer saying climate change. They're now saying climate crisis, climate emergency. And I think that's so brilliant because words really matter. Words really matter. And in writing the apology, it just became so clear to me how much words matter. Mm. When someone calls you stupid and stupid and stupid, and then they begin to write something else where they respect you and they honor you, and they take responsibility for the projection of this ugliness onto you, it changes you. Words do matter, but your words have to be deep, and they have to be reckoned, and they have to be conscious, and they have to be like really gone through a deep process of understanding.
I noticed women are talking about, writing about, sometimes posting about either their abortion or being raped or both. And it is such a curious time. On the one hand, we've got laws being passed in places like Alabama where you couldn't get an abortion even if you were raped or the victim of incest. That would be denied to you. And on the other hand, we do have more women and men as well who are speaking out. I'm just curious, as someone who's been kind of in the trenches on this issue, how you see where we are today.
Well, a couple of things. I always love what Carl Jung said about this century, that in order to survive, you have to live with two existing opposite ideas at the exact same time. And I mean, we are seeing more women coming into power, more women finding their voice, more women, and we are seeing the most insane pushback we've ever seen. And it's not surprising, right? As women come into their bodies, as they come into their voices, as they come into the seats of power, of course there's going to be a pushback. But I think also, we're living and I was thinking about this. I was at a Stop the Ban Abortion rally the other day speaking, and I was just thinking to myself, you know, patriarchy is kind of like a virus, right? It's always present in your body, but when the right and terrible toxic conditions exist, like the ones under this current predator in chief exist, the virus resurfaces. And I think this period we're living through has licensed full-out misogyny, full-out white supremacy, full-out hatred of immigrants. We can get just full-out destruction of the earth. We're going through it. And I think, I don't know that it is, all I want to say is that things come, they go. We move forward, we move back. But the struggle is long. Mm-hmm. And it is our job now to never go back. You know, our vaginas and our uteruses and our minds and our bodies and our beings are out of the bottle, and they're not going back in. That's just not going to happen. And I feel outraged that any man, any position of leg, thinks he has a right to determine what's going to go on my body or any woman's body. This is my body. And we know that now. And we have laws. We have laws. Like, we are protected by the law, and we have to uphold those laws, and we have to make sure we get people in the Supreme Court who fight for those laws, and we have to get rid of the current administration and put back people in place who uphold what the majority of the people in the 73% of the people in this country support abortion. One out of four women get abortion. This is a health issue. It is our choice. And I don't think we have to even talk about the rape and the incest piece because it doesn't matter. Abortion is our right, period. It's ludicrous that they would even throw in this piece about rape and incest. But we don't. There's a bottom line here. You don't get to mess with our rights. They have been won.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We have Sarah calling us from, looks like, Plymouth Meeting. And Sarah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you so much. I am so amazed by this interview and Eve, the work, the book that you've written and this the work that you're doing. I am a trauma therapist at a children's residential treatment center in Plymouth Meeting. It's called Silver Springs Martin Luther School. And I work with children who are victims of sexual and physical abuse. And part of our treatment, what we have an element that we call writing a clarification letter. And we actually sit with parents, whether it's or family members or an individual who is either the perpetrator, a non-protective parent, or those are absent, we will write a letter. And we go through a process of writing an apology and helping them say, I'm sorry for hurting you in these ways. And here's what I did that hurt you. Here's how it made you feel. And here's how I'm going to keep you safe in the future. And it has been such a gift that we can give to our children for them to have and hold on to give them the freedom that you're talking about. And I really just want to thank you for this work that you've written and this gift that you're going to be giving to so many people and really bringing the attention to everyone of how important that apology is.
Thank you so much. And I just want to say to you two things. Thank you for the work you're doing. Bless you for the work you're doing. Two, we have a website called theapologybook.net, and we're inviting people to send in apologies and what is an apology and why it's important. I would love you to write something about what you're doing there and send it in so other people can see this as a model of work that they could start doing, and to write anything you want about what is an apology, why is it important, and to maybe send in a few of these apologies anonymously so people could get a feel for what it looks like.
Sarah, I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
Absolutely.
And yeah, you got
apologybook.net.
There you go. And thank you also for the work that you're doing with these young people and their families. Here's an email from Kristen. I was abused by my mother, brother, and father. However, not 2 months after my mother apologized for a lifetime of abuse, she refused to see my brother's sexual obsession with me as anything but healthy curiosity. Does Eve Ensler consider that even when people apologize, it doesn't always mean they change their beliefs or behavior? We began by talking about just the complexity of an apology, that it's just not something you say. You have to do serious work to make it real.
Yeah, I would actually say that it's a journey. And I think implicit in an apology is that you have changed your behavior and your beliefs. I think, you know, if my father said I'm sorry to me and then went ahead and told me how great it was that I was getting, molested or abused by someone else, it would be an indication he didn't get it. I think you have to get it and you have to know that you and I think, you know, an I'm sorry or a, you know, we need to take the time to go in to understand our behavior, and we need to work with other people to help us process it. It took me 60 some odd years to write this book, even to get to a place where I wanted an apology from my father or would consider an apology because I was so raging. And I think we have to all take that time. So I don't think it can be rushed, and I don't. And you know, on the site we have all these advocates writing in to say what is an apology.
Right.
And Jane Fonda wrote a really wonderful thing at the end of hers. She said, "When you receive an authentic apology, you know it, because it resonates all through your body, being, mind, and heart. And when you and in that moment, you know that person has changed." Because they have gone all the way into a place of humility and to a place of vulnerability and opening, that you know they've done the work.
Do you forgive your father then?
Well, forgiveness is an interesting word.
It is.
And I've never been big on the word because I think it's always been mandated. by all kinds of things like the church and kind of like, you need to forgive him. Why haven't you forgiven him? Why don't you just get over it already? Why are you making such a fuss? Blah, blah, blah. What I believe in, I think, is the alchemy of the apology. I think when somebody has really gone through the journey and the process I'm talking about, and they look at you across the table, or they write you this letter, and you feel the depth and the searching and the seeking and the self-interrogation and the wholeness of what they've done, something profound gets released in you. Your rancor, your hatred, your desire for revenge, it just goes. And perhaps that's the closest mm-hmm. we get to forgiveness. There is just a release. So what I would say is at the end of this book, when my father says that last haunting mm-hmm. line, old man be gone.
Right.
He was gone. And he hasn't been back.
So you in a sense, banished him from your life.
No, not banished. Banished, because banished would imply I was still in a war with him.
Exactly.
He's gone. He's been released. It's over. That battle is over. He has made amends to me now. He has apologized. I'm done. I'm no longer living in the paradigm of me being permanent victim to his perpetrator. That paradigm is busted. I don't know where I'm living now. I don't know what this world is, but I'm really excited to find out.
Well, that's interesting. And because in the book, I mean, clearly as a young girl, he is a monster. I mean, he's a terrorizer. And by the end, he's this sort of broken, damaged, even fragile person.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think, I mean, look, there are real psychopaths and there are real people who can't be changed and who are so narcissistic. And that's real. And those people, we need to find a way to contain them and protect the world from them. But the majority of people are broken people who break other people, you know, hurt people who hurt people. And I think rather than building more and more and more prisons, which continue the cycle of punishment and violence, we need to be creating systems where, just like that woman was talking about, mm-hmm. how do we have people come forward to talk about what led them to do what they've done and investigate their own pain and investigate their own trauma and open up those parts of themselves that they've never been able to talk about so that they stop doing that behavior and so they can get free of what's been done to them and the terrible harms they have called other people. Because, look, patriarchy tyrannizes everyone. And to some degree, it tyrannizes men more because it separates them from their hearts. And they become human beings they don't want to be based on this pressure to be part of this male code. And I think when we can create systems that begin to go under this story and allow people to trace their trauma and go back to their trauma and relieve their trauma, we can begin to end a society that is so insanely violent and punishing.
Almost out of time here. Why do you think people want to tell you intimate things about their lives?
Probably because I've told them things about mine.
Right.
And they don't feel embarrassed and they don't feel judged. And I think part of the story of what we're doing here, at least what I'm doing here, is I think we're all trying to get free, right? We're trying to get free of rancor, of self-hatred, of jealousy, of disconnection, and I think one of the ways we get free is we stop pretending we're somebody other than we're not. We stop pretending we came from a background we didn't come from. We tell the truth on ourselves so that other people feel free to tell the truth on themselves.
Well, a perfect place to end our conversation. Eve Ensler, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. You're amazing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. And again, her book is called The Apology. And if you don't know, she's a Tony Award-winning playwright of The Vagina Monologues, an author, performer, activist, founder of V-Day, founder of 1 Million Rising. And she's got that website as well, which we will post. We'll post that on our Facebook page so people can send their apologies or read about other people's apologies. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.